This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today, episode 55. I have to remember to say that. It's been a good week. It's been a busy week. We are ramping up to make the great move. I'm going to adjust this a little bit because it seems to be there. I don't know that you'd ever hear that in the stereo field, but you know, sometimes I just like to make sure I'm looking at it straight on. Anyway, it's been a busy week, lots of stuff going on. But every day, we're making progress, and every day is a good day. And our next big cutover is going to be a week from Friday, so next week I'll be one day away from making the big cutover. But you know, every day I tell myself, will it be victory today or the challenge? Because at this point, failure is just not really in my vocabulary. It's either going to work the first time we put it through, which it should because we do lots and lots and lots of testing before we put it into production, or if it doesn't, then it's just the challenge of making it work. Because God has been good thus far, He will be good in the future. Anyways, as I said last week, Amanda and the Skleberry Tree is up. I am working on the Super Seeper project. I'm having a lot of fun with that. I actually had put in a request for some mirrors to get some pricing on some mirrors with a company in New Jersey, and the guy there had seen my email address, me@philfarron.com, so he had gone out to my website and saw that I had written some nitpicker's guides for Next Generation, and he said, you wrote some books about Star Trek. I said, yeah, and we chatted for a little while about that. And I told him, yeah, well, I've got this project going. He said, yeah, I read that on your front page. You're working on a super secret project. So I said, yep, I am. He said, well, you can be assured that we're confidential. I said, well, thanks. I appreciate that. Of course, I'm getting just those parts from him, and I'm making other parts myself. So there, you really can't tell much about the super secret projects. But it does involve mirrors. So anyways, maybe somebody will deduce what it is. This week, I had another topic that I thought I was going to do about the rise in lesbianism. But I thought, no, that needs to sort of mature a little bit. I don't know exactly what I want to talk about on that. I was reading this study. It was very interesting. So we're going to table that for a couple of weeks. We may get back around to it. But I did have an incident that happened this week. And the more I thought about it, the more interesting at least it seemed to me. And it spawned this whole idea of the anatomy of wonder. And really looking at wonder as a mechanism and saying, what can we learn from the fact that humans exhibit a sense of wonder? It all started out at church on Sunday, actually after church. We had a special service at the church where my wife is the music minister. We've just recently come to this church, so I'm not familiar with many of the people who are there. There was a man who was the treasurer there for many years. He died of cancer several months ago, and the board of the church, the people who serve on the board, really felt like it would be good to do a tribute to this man, because I guess he had served the church for many, many years, was a wonderful man, very kind. He had been an aviator in the armed forces, you know, a businessman, had a farm, did a lot of different things. And so they just wanted to have a service where they honored him and presented a plaque in his honor to his wife, and then go over to the general purpose building, which is like a gymnasium, where we could have a meal all together, and just as a way of saying to his family, we appreciated this man's life. And it was very nice. It was very nice. Well, during that meal, my wife and I had sat across from a young couple that we had sat next to at the Valentine's banquet that the church had had, and had kind of got to know them a little bit. And so we were chit-chatting about this, that, and the other, and their 10-year-old son was there, and I think he was 10. Not sure. Anyways, their young son was there, and So we had kind of a chance to talk to him about what kind of sports he liked and all those things, what kind of things he was involved in. And, you know, we were just doing the whole family chat thing. And somehow we got onto the topic after this young man got up and went over and was playing with somebody else. We got onto the topic of the father's younger brother. And he said, yeah, he said, my younger brother, he said, he's really into philosophy. He said he's got all these books on philosophy, and he's constantly reading about philosophy. And every time he gets around my son, he just starts telling him all the things that he needs to think about, and telling him how you got to think for yourself, and you got to question your parents because, you know, they're not always right. And so you got to think for yourself. And he just really pushing this whole thing. And I smiled, because obviously this activity that this younger brother is engaging in, where he is buttonholing this young man who I think is about 10 years old, for me, obviously, that behavior, there's no question that that behavior is motivated by the flesh, because it's not this younger brother's responsibility to raise this child. It's the father's responsibility to raise the child. And the younger brother, the father was saying, justifies it by, well, I'm helping your son. You know, I'm helping him to think for himself. Okay, well, that's fine. that's fine. But I looked at the father and I said, yeah, I said, I understand. I said, sometimes people feel like they have to just go around and push and push and push and push. I said, but you know, you should take comfort in the fact that there is something that no amount of persuasion can stand against. No amount of encouraging by anyone else will be able to change your son's mind. Because there is a thing that can leap over any barricade that anyone would ever try to erect. And I said, that's love. I said, love just trumps all of that stuff. And I said, as long as your son knows that you love him, and as long as you keep that relationship with him good, I said, everything is going to be fine. And I didn't say this to him, but part and parcel of that is that if you're really showing your love to your children, they will understand that you are dedicated to their success, that you are dedicated to help them become all that they can be in life and have their own quests and epics. And just as important in all that, as we talked several weeks ago, is the idea that as you live your life, you live a life that has the markings of success on it, not just money, not fame, any of those things, but the marking of success in terms of how you treat those around you and how your life is seasoned with the supernatural, that the supernatural is just part of every breath that you take. And if children can grow up seeing that in their parents, all these people that are sitting around and saying, as this younger brother was saying, well, you know, if I can't see it, if I can't explain it rationally, if I can't observe it and, you know, prove it scientifically, I just don't believe in it. It has got to make sense to me. And I told the father later, I said, you know what honestly amuses me about that mindset, that everything has to make sense to me, is that what he's really saying is, I have such high regard for this 3 pounds of goo that's between my ears that the entire universe is required to order itself such that I or people like me can understand it. And I said, honestly, that could be interpreted to be a very egotistical thing. Really, us tiny little scraps of dirt on this planet, we have the hubris to say that the entire universe has to conform itself to my limitations of perceptions and cognitions And it is all out there for me to discover. I mean, that's pretty interesting. And it's pretty egotistical. If you believe that, in fact, that 3 pounds of goo that sits between your ears is the result of random chance. All the more so if you spend any time following any of the amazing discoveries that are being made in really any scientific field of study. But for our purposes, we'll just talk about astronomy, because I just saw a really cool NOVA special called Hunting the Edge of Space. I think it was called Hunting the Edge of Space. And it was about the huge telescopes that are being built and pointed. And it's so cool. But they were talking about how in 1995, and I had heard about this, but it reminded me of it, and I went, oh yeah, that's real cool. In 1995, how some scientists procured some time on the Hubble Space Telescope, which of course is very high dollar, precious time, and they decided that what they were going to do is not point it at anything that they could see in the sky, but rather, they would find a dark spot, and they would focus in on that dark spot and just point it there for a while. Even though it looked like there was nothing there. And they said it would be comparable to taking a drinking straw and pointing it at a dark spot in the sky. And they routed Hubble over to this spot, opened up the cameras, and let it just sit on this spot for 10 days. And when they got back the image, which is called the deep field image, they counted something like 10,000 galaxies in this little tiny area of space that had never been seen before and could only be seen because you've got the Hubble Space Telescope pointing at it for 10 days with its aperture wide open. And they were saying each of those galaxies had approximately 100 billion stars. I mean, you know, there's numbers. There's numbers that get so big. They get so big that you just can't really get your brain around it anymore. Beyond that, a couple of years later, they actually found another spot where they thought was even darker. And they pointed the Hubble at that spot. And left the aperture open forever, whatever. And that became the ultra deep field image. And in fact, several months ago, I printed out a copy of the ultra deep field image. And I have it on my wall in my office. Because you look at this image, well, I look at this image, and it just fills me with wonder. It's just amazing. And so anyone who's had any exposure to that, sometimes you wonder how they can make the claim that, well, you know, it has to make sense to me before I'll believe in it. Well, okay, but look at how big everything is. Are you really going to say that all that out in that vastness, that there's not going to be anything that you're not going to be able to comprehend? Now, even watching this program, it really is cool what humanity has been able to accomplish. I mean, they went through the progression about how telescopes were created, and they go through this progression of how that at every stage they had their theories, and then they built something and looked somewhere, and then suddenly wait, that doesn't make sense. And they go and they look at it and they get more data and it like turns the theories upside down and they go back after it again. But it is true that at every stage that humanity has seemingly been able to come up with a solution, an explanation for how things work. And I will grant you, that really is pretty amazing. But doesn't it also seem a bit contrived? I mean, really, when you really look at it, doesn't it seem a bit contrived when you lift your eyes up to the heavens and see the amazing stuff that's there and how vast the heavens are? And when you consider that we are little specks of dust on this mediocre little planet slung off at the unfashionable west end of the Milky Way galaxy, as Douglas Adams would say in the Hitchhiker's Guide trilogy, that we would be able to figure this stuff out. This is really cool. And frankly, it seems a bit contrived that things just happen to be set up such that when we investigate, we have just enough information to reach a hypothesis that works just well enough that we think we've figured something out, that it makes us interested to try to keep figuring things out, even when we find out what we think we figured out, in fact, we didn't figure out, and so we need to adjust our theories. And this is constantly the process of science, and yet no matter what science pursues, there are always these steps involved, and we never seem to hit a dead end. It's like a game. And if it is a game, it's a very well-constructed game. But beyond all that, beyond the coincidence and the contrivance, seeming contrivance, of the fact that we just happen to have a brain that can figure things out, and we just happen to be in a universe that presents itself in such a way that our brains can figure things out. Because the universe could be something that could be figured out, except not for our brains. Or our brains could be configured such that we aren't really good at figuring things out, even though the universe was imminently discoverable. But we've got this combination, and then beyond that combination, we have this thing, this wonder. Because there's not necessarily any prerequisite of just because you can analyze and make things work, you necessarily are interested in the bigger questions. I mean, there's one spot where, on this Hunting the Edge of Space, they were showing how that they are studying the redshift on stars. Okay, this is not something that today or tomorrow or the next day or the next day or the next day or potentially ever is going to help us grow more food, help us make more money, help us figure out how to procreate better. You know, we as humans, we have some like basic needs. We need shelter, we need food, we need to procreate. And studying the redshift on stars, it's probably going to be a while before that really impacts any of those things. I'm getting my mail. And yet here we have scientists who are being paid to study the redshift on stars. And they've got this device Whereas in the old days, what they would have to do is they would observe the light from one star. Now they have this device where they can observe the light from 640 stars simultaneously. And to do this, they make these big metal discs that are set up with little holes drilled for each star that they want to study. And they have a bunch of these discs. And so for an evening, what they have to do is they take out the disc, they put it into this frame, and then by hand, they take these little LED receptors and load them into these 640 slots. Tick, click, click, click. One at a time. And I'm watching this, and I'm thinking, she is getting paid to do this. I'm backing into my garage. She is getting paid to put LEDs in this metal disc so that they can measure the redshift of stars, 640 stars at a time. Why? Because we as human beings are curious. We're not like gorillas or chimpanzees or dogs. We look up and we go, huh, look at that. Wonder what's out there. We look up and say, wonder how the sun works. Wonder what it's like not on our planet. And we reach for those things. And there's not really any reason why we would have to do that, because there's no immediate improvement in our lives. We just wonder and we're curious. And I would submit to you that that wonder and curiosity is not something that you can ever quantify, that you can ever build a formula for. Maybe someday we can isolate a period of the section of the brain and just say, okay, if we cut that thing out, then people don't wonder and aren't curious anymore. But as to exactly how and why we started that wonderment, that probably will lie beyond our ability to explain it rationally. And we always come back to, well, I'm just curious. I just wonder. Because I firmly believe that the anatomy of wonder is that it starts directly from a whisper from God saying, this is cool. You should look into this. Look what's up here. Keep looking. And every time we discover something, God's up there going, good job. Good job. And so for me, even for the person who is sitting out there and saying, well, the only way I'm going to believe in something is if I can explain it rationally, if I can put it down on paper, if I can do a scientific experiment, if I can quantify it to make it objective, then I'll believe in it. To me, there is even underneath all that, this wonder and curiosity that really has no rational explanation, but is in fact in the midst of all that egoism being birthed from something that is far more than just egotistical. It is this idea that we can know, that we can investigate, this certainty for which we have no basis, and yet we still believe it. And it is that idea that is a wonderful, wonderful thing to embrace. Because honestly, even the most egotistical person that is self-centered and simply believes that only what I think should be real, only what I can prove rationally should be real, when they get exposed to some of these really cool discoveries and you hear them talking and you hear the scientists talking, it's not just ego. It is. You can see it in their eyes. You can hear it in their voice. They think this universe and our existence is a really cool thing. And that's simply because it is. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.